Pull it from her.
Hello. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, y'all know my audio as well as my video has been messing up on my computer, so I just want to make sure. All right, so let's start with some questions. So you've got a patient and they are on a loop diuretic. That's going to be your furosemide, for example. What should we check before we administer this medication?
Blood pressure.
Blood pressure for one. It's going to drop their blood pressure. Okay, so we want to know their blood pressure. And then somebody else just said it. What was the other?
Potassium.
Potassium. Okay. So if their blood pressure was 90 over 50, are we going to hold it or give it?
Hold it.
Hold it.
You're going to hold it. Okay. If their potassium is 3.2, you're going to hold it or give it?
Hold it.
Hold it.
Hold it. Okay. What if their potassium was 5.6?
Give it.
Give it.
Give it. It's going to help to drop that potassium. What's the normal potassium?
3.5 to 5.
Okay. What's a normal sodium?
135 to 145.
Okay. So we've administered our furosemide and our patient begins to tell us that they're hearing ringing in their ears. Is that something that we should be concerned about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we know that the loop diuretics can cause tinnitus, the ototoxicity. All right, so we have administered this furosemide to our patients. And so we said that we should expect that they're going to lose potassium and that they are going to have a drop in their blood pressure. What are some other things that we would expect, some expected findings from this furosemide?
Increased urinary output.
Correct. We expect them to start having an increase in urine output. So kind of going along with that, when should we administer furosemide?
Morning.
In the morning.
Preferably in the morning, because we don't want them getting up at all hours of the night. You know, drowsy, sleepy, going to pee. And then the next thing you know, you got your patient that has failed. What are some other, besides blood pressure, urine output, what are some other measurements that would help us determine that our loop diuretic is working? Daily weight.
Blood pressure. Weights.
Weights. Right. Weight, daily weight is going to be one of your more reliable ways to determine how much fluid you're drawing out of a patient. And so, you know, if you check them on admission and, you know, they're 195 pounds, you've administered a diuretic, you've seen the decrease in blood pressure, you've seen the increase in urine output, the next day, you should be able to correlate that with a drop in the daily weight. All right, so for your thiazide diuretics, all right, so we know that these are a little bit weaker of a diuretic. These are going to be PO. These are patient, you know, this is a, you know, pick it up at the pharmacy, the patient takes it every day. What is some of the people that we would expect to see taking this medication? Used in? IV? Somebody's muted. I see their mouth moving, but I can't hear them. Okay, so
we couldn't hear you for a second.
Okay, so it's first line for hypertension. Okay, so this is first line, patient comes in, it's first time we've diagnosed them with hypertension, it's first line hypertension. And so, you know, we want to, you know, encourage our patients, you know, that they need to, you know, check their blood pressure before taking this medication. We need to educate the patients, you know, to take this in the morning as well. So it's an oral pill, so we're not as concerned with, you know, the drop in the potassium, but it still can cause the drop in the potassium. So what are some dietary things that our patients could take to increase their potassium? What's some things they could eat? High potassium foods.
Banana, spinach, dark green leafy stuff.
Almonds and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Potatoes, tomatoes.
Yeah. Good deal. Y'all got them. All right. So the one odd thing that we said about our thiazide was that these patients are taking the thiazide, the hydrochlorothiazide, you have to have good renal function. So our loop diuretics, what was the only couldn't take it? Well, I mean, there were a couple that couldn't take it, but what was our biggest, who can't take a diuretic, a loop diuretic?
Liver disease patients.
Kidney patients.
Absolutely no urine. If your kidneys are not producing any urine whatsoever, you cannot take a loop diuretic. All right. With our thiazide diuretics, we don't want to give it to patients who are in any type of chronic kidney disease. Okay. So that's kind of our oddity. Our other ones, we can give it with kidney disease up until the point when they are not producing urine. But however, our thiazide diuretics, we're not going to administer that to any patient who has any type of chronic kidney disease. All right, our potassium sparing diuretics, that was our spironolactone. The oddity, the thing that makes this one stand out is that it's allowing the body to keep the potassium. It's getting rid of the fluid, it's getting rid of the sodium, but we get to hold on to the potassium. So for this situation, we've got our patient that we were talking about earlier, their potassium is 3.2. Are we gonna hold spironolactone or are we gonna give spironolactone?
Give it.
We're gonna give it. Okay. But if their potassium is 5.6, we're gonna give it, we're gonna hold it.
Hold it.
Okay. So it's kind of just opposite where we were with our loop diuretics. So because we know that there is holding on to this potassium, their risk for hyperkalemia, what are some signs that our patient is having hyperkalemia?
Elevated T waves.
Elevated T waves. Dysrhythmias, they're going to tell you, I feel like my heart's running away. And so we're always going to remember in our head, potassium, heart, potassium. So those patients are going to need to be on some cardiac monitoring. We're going to monitor their heart rate, their pulse. Are these the people we're going to tell to eat the potatoes, spinach, almonds, bananas?
No.
We want to reduce oral intake of potassium for these patients. All right, the other odd thing about the spironolactone is it causes some of those endocrine effects, the gynecomastia, the deep voice, the menstrual irregularities. And so, you know, just, you know, kind of pay attention to those. So on your spironolactone, a lot of those same things that we talked about, you know, we're going to expect the blood pressure to go down. Okay. We expect that the sodium is probably going to go down. We expect the potassium is going to stay about the same because it's potassium sparing. And then our daily weights, we expect our daily weights to go down as well. All right, so mannitol is our other diuretic. It's not used as much for blood pressure. It's more specifically used for increased intracranial pressure as well as increased ocular pressure. And so you know, we still classify it as a diuretic because it's pulling fluid from somewhere it's not supposed to be in order to send it to the kidneys to send it outward. It's just not used for the same things that our others are used for. So when we looked at our complications, because we're pulling all this extra fluid into the vascular space, that heart failure and pulmonary edema, we're creating more fluid in the blood volume. And so it can cause that pulmonary congestion, cardiac congestion. What are some signs and symptoms that we would tell us that our osmotic diuretics are causing that? What are some things that we would see and hear in our patients?
Shortness of breath.
Increase in weight.
You would hear breath sounds. What are they going to sound like? Crackles. You'd hear the crackles in the chest. Who are some patients that we would not administer these osmotic diuretics to?
Renal failure.
CHF.
So we would be cautious in CHF. Okay. If they've got significant intracranial bleeding, no, not intracranial bleeding, that's who can't have it. Anybody who has intracranial bleeding. If we've got increased intracranial pressure and we also have congestive heart failure, I've still got to get the fluid out of the brain. Okay. I've just got to be more cautious in making sure that I am really pushing the kidneys to get rid of that fluid to not drown out the heart. Your chronic kidney disease, we can still give it as long as they are producing urine. Okay. This is going to fall into that same, if they're producing urine, we can still administer it. We just can't administer it once they get to the point of not producing urine. All right, so we cannot give it to hemorrhagic strokes, intracranial bleeds, completely contraindicated in those patients. How would we administer this as a nurse? What's important when we are hanging this bag of mannitol?
Ensure there's a filter.
We have to make sure there's a filter on it. Okay, it is administered continuous IV as long as you have a filter on the line to collect any substrates that have developed in the bag. We're still going to be monitoring those daily weights, our vital signs, but we're also going to monitor that intracranial pressure with osmotic diuretics. All right, let's move on and talk about some of our cardiacs. So the first ones that we talked about was your ACEs. Those are your preels, captopril, enalapril, lisinopril. All of those preels are gonna be your ACE inhibitors. What were some of the side effects to our ACEs?
Dry cough.
Dry cough is probably the most common. What are we going to do if our patient reports a dry cough?
Stop the medicine,
notify the provider. Okay. What are some other adverse events or complications?
Orthostatic hypotension.
Neutropenia.
Orthostatic hypotension and the neutropenia. Let's talk about that orthostatic hypotension most commonly with the first dose. We've got to be very, very careful on that first dose. And so for that first dose, knowing that that can happen, we want them to be on some type of continuous blood pressure monitoring so that if they do develop that, we can catch it. The neutropenia, yes, it can cause neutropenia, which is a decrease in the white blood cells. So as nurses, knowing that it's going to cause that, what is something that we're going to, first of all, monitor for, and second of all, educate our patient?
Fever.
We are going to educate them on signs and symptoms of infection and to call the doctor if they have any. We're going to look at our lab work and look at their neutrophils and white blood cells to ensure that they don't have any low levels of that. And basically, most important, the signs and symptoms of infection of any type of illness.
Right. We want to educate our patient on it. And then we as nurses also want to monitor for those signs and symptoms of infection. All right. So with our ACEs, when we're monitoring them and preparing them to take this medication, you know, we're going to make sure that they understand that orthostatic hypotension, monitor the cough. There was one other side effect that we didn't mention.
Angioedema.
The angioedema, monitor for angioedema. So if they start to see their tongue swelling, you know, we want them to know you need to get help right away. Go ahead, stop that medication. Don't continue to take it. We don't want the swelling going all the way to the throat. All right, so next we talked about our ARBs. Those are going to be our sartans, losartan, irbesartan, candesartan, all those sartans. And so when we talked about our ARBs, what were some of our complications or side effects that we can expect from them? Well, are the same thing, right? The angioedema. Okay, it doesn't cause the dry cough. But it causes the angioedema. It can cause the hypotension, you know, the drowsiness, the lightheadedness. So remember with your ARBs that basically what it's doing is it's blocking that angiotensin II, and so it's resulting in the dilation of your blood vessels. It's opening up all of the blood vessels, and so you know when we're you know. Talking about our patients and educating them, some of that dizziness and lightheadedness is because when we open up all those blood vessels, it decreases the blood pressure to our brain. And so you can have some of that lightheadedness and hypertension with that. Monitor for your hypotension. If the patient is on losartan, again, monitor your daily weights. Now, for slide number, I don't have my slides numbered, but for your aldosterone antagonist, you can basically put an X through those three slides. That's going to include your spironolactone. We've talked about that in your renal lecture, and so I would focus more on those. So you can mark out, I think it's slide 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So 8, 9, and 10 you can mark out. All right, so your calcium channel blockers, those are going to be your nifedipine, verapamil, diltiazem. For those, you know, focus on the nifedipine and the amlodipines. Those are going to be your peripheral edema, causing, you know, the swelling in your fingers and in your toes. They can also cause reflex tachycardia. And that's because when your blood pressure initially drops, your heart's going to try to beat faster to raise that blood pressure. The heart will automatically start compensating. Verapamil can cause the constipation, and so if we're administering verapamil, we need to encourage our patients to increase their fiber intake, increase their fluid intake to help keep their stools soft. On your beta blockers, so we talked about different types. So you had your cardioselective beta blockers, that's going to be like your metoprolol. Those affect only the heart. And then your propranolol, remember that one was non-cardioselective. It affects both your heart and your lungs. So if you've got a patient who has asthma, are you going to want them on a cardioselective or a non-cardioselective beta
blocker? Cardioselective, because they can't have propranolol.
They cannot have propranolol. It's going to cause them to have increased bronchoconstriction, making their asthma worse. So our propranolol, we're going to avoid in our asthma patients. We know that this is going to decrease our heart rate. And so what are we going to monitor before we administer this?
Their pulse, their pulse rate. We're going to make sure that.
Greater than
60.
60 is kind of our target. We've got several medications this time that we talk about with monitoring their heart rate beforehand. And so we're going to stick with that 60. We want everybody to have a 60 before we give them anything that's going to drop their heart rate.
Okay. Can I say something, Ms. Altman? I was about to ask that because in ATI, it keeps saying below 50. We know DH is below 60, you hold it, but it keeps saying if it's below 50, you hold these medication, but you want us to run with the below 60 guideline?
Yes.
Okay.
Run with 60. I wrote your test based on 60. So when my test goes 60, when you take ATI, you may want to go 50.
Okay.
All right. So for your digoxin, we know that digoxin is going to make it slow and strong. It's going to slow the heart rate down, but it's going to make those contractions more forceful. This is not used for your hypertension. This is for your heart failures and your atrial fibs. And so your complications, when we slow the heart rate down, it can cause dysrhythmias. It can create some of your sinus bradycardias. And then we know that DIG also has a tox level. We know that we have to monitor for DIG toxicity. And so what are some of the signs and symptoms of DIG toxicity? Too much DIG.
Halos. Those halos, vision changes.
Yeah, they're going to see the yellow hellos. They're going to hear, you know, ringing in their ears. They're going to have anorexia. They're going to be really, really sleepy. So those are going to be some of your signs of your DIG tox. Excuse me. So this one, again, we're holding with a pulse below 60. We want to not administer this medication with any type of antacids because those antacids are going to decrease the absorption of that DIG, creating those low DIG levels that are not helping your patient.
Ms. Altman, can I ask you a question right here?
Use your game.
In our ATI books, like some people got the therapeutic level is 0.5 to 0.8. Some got 0.5 to 2.0. Now I Googled it and I was like, okay, heart failure is like 0.5 to 0.9 and dysrhythmia is 0.5 to 2.0. But what do you want us to go by?
Okay. My standard answer for that is I am not expecting you to memorize normal or abnormal labs. If you are working in a hospital, every time you get a lab value right beside it, it's going to be the normal.
Oh my God, you're so right. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
That is the best thing anybody have said.
Did you hear me? I started to shout, Marilyn, but I wasn't going to do it. I just said thank you. That was my way of shutting up, okay?
Yeah. Now, obviously, yes, there are some things like your sodium and potassium. I do want you to know normal sodium and a normal potassium, but I feel like, you know, that's one of those things that, like, everybody is just gonna know. But a DIG tox level, no, you don't need to know a DIG tox level. So your adrenergic agonist, that's going to be your epi and your norepi. These are going to raise blood pressure. These are your pressors. And so what they're doing is they're increasing, you know, the vasoconstriction in the periphery to help keep blood flow going to your heart. This is going to be your ICU patients for the most part. So your epi and your norepi cause vasoconstriction. Your dobutamine is going to increase the heart rate and increase the cardiac output. So when you're looking at your complications, so your epi is going to cause dysrhythmias and hypertensive crisis, and then your norepi is going to cause necrosis. Basically, what's happening is the vasoconstriction in the periphery is so tight and closes down to conserve blood flow to the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the core, that it can cause necrosis of the distal fingertips and the toes because it's not getting any blood. It's closed down and constricted those blood vessels to save the core. On your norepi and your dobutamine must be on a pump, must be on an IV pump, and you must perform those neurovascular checks, checking for that necrosis. Do we still have good cap refill? Do we have color in the fingers and the toes? Make sure you monitor the perfusion on the extremities. All right, your organic nitrites, that's going to be your nitroglycerin, your isosorbide. You know, obviously we all know that nitro is given with any type of cardiac, you know, suspected even cardiac coronary artery disease. Heart attack is where I'm trying to go, and my brain ain't thinking. It is a vasodilator. It opens up the blood vessels to allow maximum blood flow to get to the heart. But in doing so, it also opens it up in the brain. And so we know that that first thing that patient's going to say is, oh my God, my head hurts. Okay. And so we got to comfort the patient. That's an expected side effect. We expect that. That means the medicine is working, and we hope that it's opening up those arteries in the heart as well. It can cause significant hypotension. And so if you're giving it for a cardiac patient, yeah, you want to know what that blood pressure is, but most of the time you're still going to give it. You're going to have to supplement that blood pressure and put some fluids to the patient. It's going to decrease the oxygen demand, increase the oxygen delivery, can cause the headache. Who cannot take? So you got a patient, they come in, they're having chest pain, and you know, you're talking to them and they tell you that they just took Viagra. Can you give it to them?
No, ma'am, because it'll cause hypotension.
It will cause significant hypotension to the point the brain does not get any blood. All right. Your antidysrhythmics. Whole bunch of them. There's a whole bunch of them on there, but let's narrow that down a little bit for you. On your antidysrhythmics, the one that you are going to see most of the time in practice is going to be your amiodarone. Okay. So focus in on your amiodarone. What are some side effects of your amiodarone?
Pulmonary toxicity. It's like a complication, you're saying?
Yes. It also causes visual disturbances. Okay. And so that's an a known side effect of your amiodarone. When you're looking at the list of like what treats what, you know, amiodarone is supposed to be used for like your ventricular tachycardias, most of your ventricular dysrhythmias. So I'm trying to pull up your slide. I think it's 26 on the purposes. So for class one is your lidocaine. I don't even want you to focus on lidocaine. We do still occasionally use it, but very rarely. Propranolol, we use it, but we just learned about propranolol. Okay, it's a beta adrenergic blocker. We just talked about that on a different slide. So focus on your amiodarones, which is your class three. It's VFib, VTAC, and then we've started using it for AFib, A-flutter. Okay, so you've got a patient that comes in and they are in VFib. Which of these medications are you going to administer? Propranolol, amiodarone, diltiazem, adenosine?
Amiodarone.
Very good. All right. For your miscellaneous, your adenosine, remember that your adenosine is only going to be used for your SVT and your Wolff-Parkinson-White. Okay. That's when your heart rate is bounding. Okay, it is a quick push. It is a rapid push. You push it in as fast as you can get it in, and you flush it in as fast as you can get it in. It's basically going to stop the heart and make it restart. Okay, but its effects last for moments, very few moments. So for adenosine, the only thing I want you to know is it's used for SVT. All right, your other one, digoxin. We just learned all about digoxin. Okay, so you already know that one. All right, so focus on your amiodarone in these slides. The slide number 26 tells you what they do. Slide number 27 on your complications. I wouldn't focus on any of those. I wouldn't even look at the complications other than the visual disturbances. With your class three, that's going to be your amiodarone. Contraindications. I wouldn't focus on any of your contraindications or whatever. what word did I just say? Contraindication. All right, going to slide 28. Interactions.
Ms. Altman, can I ask a quick question?
You sure can.
Just for clarification's sake, because we just had this question come up. So the patients that are in BFib, I understand that per like this slide, right? The answer is amiodarone. However, per ACLS protocol, your answer is actually epi. Like your first line treatment for that in a coding situation is epinephrine. So for the purpose of the test, if I choose epi, is that going to be wrong?
You're not going to have the option to choose epi or amiodarone.
Okay.
For my test. Now, when you get to ACLS, yes, you do have to know that ACLS says that epi is first.
Okay.
In all my years of working in the ER, you know, obviously epi is first. But if your patient is in significant VFib, VTAC, you know, epi is very short-lived as well. And so typically amio is more effective, but that is neither here nor there. This class is not about what I have found in my practice. It is about what the book says. And so for the purpose of this pharmacology class, this pharmacology class, when you're talking about antidysrhythmics for VTAC or VFib, the answers will only give you amiodarone, propranolol, or lidocaine.
Okay.
You won't have the option to choose epi. All right, so on that very last dysrhythmia slide, the interactions I wouldn't worry about for your nursing administration on your amiodarone, I do want you to focus on it has a loading dose and then it must be titrated. All right, so it is highly toxic, and so you will give your loading dose of 12.5 milligrams over 2 minutes, and then it is titrated based on 5 to 25 mics per mg. I'm sorry, mics per kg. So just know that you're going to give a loading dose, and then they are going to get a small titration to maintain a therapeutic level of amiodarone. All right. Your statins. Statins are easy to pick out because they all end in the word statin. They are used to treat hypercholesterolemia. When you're looking at your complications, there's two. Hepatotoxicity. So your patients are going to have routine liver monitoring, check their liver enzymes throughout and before you administer or before you start. And then also the myopathy. Myopathy is probably the biggest reason that patients stop taking statin. And, you know, it's going to come to you as my legs hurt, my muscles hurt, my legs ache. And so that is going to be the myopathy that you will hear from your patients. Nursing administration wise, when do we want them to take their statins?
In the evening.
Preferably in the evening. We know that cholesterol is synthesized during our sleep, and so if we take the medication, it is most effective as we sleep. All right, moving on to hematologic. All right, so first group of medicines was our anticoagulants, our heparin, and our low molecular weight heparin. So heparin is to treat, I need this anticoagulation like right now. These are like urgent anticoagulants. And then your enoxaparin is going to be used more for prophylactic type stuff. If you have been in a hospital situation, I feel like pretty much every nurse has administered enoxaparin for DVT prophylaxis. I feel like the doctors at Mithin, go ahead, just everybody gets it, whether they're at risk of DVT or not. What is our biggest concern on heparin or enoxaparin?
Bleeding.
Monitor for signs and symptoms of bleeding. Bleeding precautions. Avoiding combining them with your NSAIDs and your aspirins, because we know that's going to put them at increased risk for GI bleeds. All right, your oral anticoagulant is your Coumadin. Coumadin, we know that we've got to tell our patients you're going to have consistent monitoring of your PT INR. That's another one. I don't need you to memorize the PT, the INR levels. You know, it's different based on whether they're taking it for, you know, AFib versus, you know, depending on what they're taking it, there's going to be a different range. And every provider who is going to be ordering them warfarin for whatever is going to determine what they want the therapeutic range to be. So I don't need you to memorize those values. I just need you to know they are going to have that routine monitoring. What type of diet things do our patients on Coumadin need to know?
Avoid green leafy vegetables.
Avoid the green leafy vegetables. Basically, the things that are going to be high in vitamin K, but that's because the vitamin K and the warfarin, you know, work against each other. They are antagonists of each other. Also, remember that patients on warfarin need to be taught those bleeding precautions as well. Like they, you know, they prefer that we use electric razors with these patients. They need to avoid the NSAIDs, you know, all those.
Medical alert bracelet.
Medical alert bracelets, exactly. Your antiplatelets are going to be your aspirins and your clopidogrels. You know, these are going to reduce the aggregation of platelets. Again, you know, we're putting these patients on bleeding precautions. We're going to monitor for those thrombocytopenias. All right. So then the big one in this section was the TPA. So the TPA is the clot buster. The anticoagulants, the warfarins, the heparins, the clopidogrels, those all prevent clots, all right? Your thrombolytics break up, dissolve clots, all right? And so most facilities are going to have a 2-to-3-page form checklist of anybody. You're going to have to go through and check off all of these things. Have they had any type of recent surgery? Have they ever had any type of aneurysm? Have they ever, you know, huge laundry list of patients who cannot take these? Because if we're breaking up clots in the brain, aka a stroke, or breaking up clots in the heart, aka heart attack, and they got some little bitty, you know, aneurysm over there that's been clotted off for 6 months, and all of a sudden we open that one up, that's not a good thing. Now we've got a bleeding out patient. Once we administer this, there is no taking it back. Okay? There's no antidote for TPA. Once it's in, whatever you get is what you got. All right? So we have to be very, very careful. Every facility, like I said, has a checklist that has to be checked off before a patient is administered a thrombolytic. Risk for bleeding, risk for bleeding, risk for bleeding, risk for bleeding, risk for bleeding. Monitor your blood pressures, monitor your heart rates. You know, very closely monitor your patient's, you know, urine output for blood in the urine, stool for blood in the stool. This person is not going to get any extra IV sticks. Okay, this is not the person that the lab is going to come and just do random sticks here and there to draw some, you know, random lab that probably doesn't even matter. So before you administer the TPA, make sure you've got good IV access, because we're not going to stick them again afterwards. You know, if you've got lab orders, make sure you collected anything and everything you need before you administer the TPA. GI prophylaxis. These patients are not going to be getting any NSAIDs. These patients aren't going to be getting any aspirins. You know, monitor the stool, monitor the urine. All right. You can mark off the slides on erythropoietin growth factors. If you work in a dialysis or a cancer center, you will need to know those. But otherwise, I would say you can skip those. All right, that brings us to our blood transfusions. You got packed red blood cells, packed red blood cells. Name says it all. It is packed red blood cells, okay? It is going to be administered to patients who do not have enough red blood cells. Red blood cells are necessary for transporting oxygen everywhere in our body. And so, you know, this is going to help to perfuse with oxygen, all of, so when you look at what it's used for, any type of symptomatic anemias, hemoglobinopathies, medication-induced hemolytic anemias, all those things. Anybody who needs more oxygen delivered because there's not enough red blood cells is going to get packed red blood cells. This includes people who are hemorrhaging. This includes your traumas who come in who, you know, they've been stabbed, shot, car wrecks, whatever, they're bleeding out. They're getting packed red blood cells. All right. On your complications, your hemolytic anemias, non-hemolytic anemias, your hemolytic reactions, those blood transfusion reactions are pretty much going to be a risk for all of your bloods. So pick the ones that are different. So for packed red blood cells, your risk is hyperkalemia. Okay, that's different from the ones that we're about to talk about. They're not going to be at risk for hyperkalemias. And then also your sepsis. All of your blood, your contraindications are either they have had some type of reaction in the past to a blood transfusion, or they have religious cultural issues against it. There are certain religions and certain cultures that do not want blood, and so we do not give it to them. All right, so your packed red blood cells, anybody that needs red blood cells, whether you're losing them, whether you're just not creating enough of them, you need the red blood cells, okay? Your fresh frozen plasma is going to be used to increase your volume, to increase your blood volume. It replaces those coagulation factors. We're giving them the plasma, just the juice of the blood. All right. So again, all those blood reactions are still there, but now all the ones that we're looking at is circulatory overload. Underline it, circle it. If we're giving them the liquid, the fluid part of blood, then we're worried about giving them too much fluid. I'm going to have to call you back. Okay, well, I'm on a teleconference. Can you wait 16 minutes? Thank you. Okay, so we're giving them the fluid part. We're worried about the circulatory overload. And then you've got albumin. The albumin is the expander. This is going to be for patients who have had like those paracentesis where we're pulling lots and lots of fluid out of the abdominal cavity. And so we're going to give them back this albumin, that big molecule to help hold the fluid in the vascular system. And so when we're looking at, burn patients, the paracentesis patients, those type of patients, your complications again are the fluid volume excess. We're giving them something to hold fluid inside the vein. Our concern is that fluid volume overload. All right, so now, for the administration of all of it, the packed red blood cells, the FFP, the albumin, all right, there's specific things that you have to pay attention to. So first of all, you've got to make sure that you get the patient's consent. They sign a separate blood consent before, all right? Then you're going to have to verify when you go get the blood from the blood bank. You verify all the patient's information at the blood bank. You get back to the bedside. You do it again with a second nurse at the bedside. You're verifying the patient's blood type, the type of blood that you got from the blood bank, the specific blood bag numbers. So then when you're doing it at the bedside with the second nurse, you want to make sure that you're putting it through a large bore IV. You either want, most of the time places are going to tell you they want an 18. We can do it through a 20. We don't like to do it through a 20. And that's because those red blood cells are very fragile, remember? And so we start trying to push them through these little bitty angiocaths. We damage the red blood cells, and then it's not as beneficial to the patient. All right, so when you hang it only with normal saline through a Y connector. So you got your normal saline bag, you got your blood bag hanging, it hangs through a Y. It's administered to the patient through the specific blood tubing. Now, when you pick it up from the blood bank, you have got 30 minutes from the time you pick it up from the blood bank until the time you hang it and push the go on the IV pump. All right, you've got 4 hours from the time you pick it up to the blood bank until you should be pushing stop. So 30 minutes to push start, and 4 hours to push stop. You are going to stay with the patient at the bedside for the first 15 to 30 minutes because that is when the majority of all of your transfusion reactions are going to occur. So while you are at the bedside, you are checking their blood pressure, temperature, getting everything before you push start. You push start, and then for the next 15 to 30 minutes, you're monitoring that temperature, monitoring that blood pressure, because that's when your reactions are going to occur. Look at my notes, make sure I didn't miss anything. Only normal saline, safety check at bedside. All right, if the transfusion reaction does occur, if you notice that they're having an increase in blood pressure, if their temperature goes up, for any of those, you want to stop the transfusion. Okay, so stop the Y set that you've got connected. You're going to eventually send that whole set back to the blood bank, and they're going to retest it. But you're going to open up normal saline. So stop the connecting that's already there, a totally separate bag of normal saline with a totally separate tubing, connect to the patient, open up the normal saline, check the vitals, notify the provider, and depending on the type of reaction, if it's a febrile reaction, they're going to tell you to administer some Tylenol. Continue to monitor the patient. If it's an allergic one, they're going to tell you to give some Benadryl, things like that. Continue monitoring the patient. But for all of them, the first step is to stop the blood and administer normal saline through a separate line. You will then take the blood with the normal saline and the tubing. It will all get packaged up and sent back to the blood bank for analysis afterwards. All right, and that's all I have in my notes. Any questions from y'all?
No, I needed this. I was studying too much.
Okay, what's up?
I have a question about the reactions. So okay. Just for like test purposes, that way I'll know kind of how to study for it. So with the question, will we have them formatted like patient presents with itching, flushing, urticaria, and we have to depict what kind of reaction it is, or is it so much like what to give them if they have a mild allergic reaction type of thing?
So as this is a pharmacology class, I'm not testing you on how you're going to treat the reactions. That is a med-surg class, not a pharmacology class.
Lord, I'm panicking for this test.
Don't panic.
But I knew from our talking, I watched your lecture. I knew more than I thought I knew, but we'll know when that exam soft start, when that test start.
I feel like cardiac is always hard. Cardiac is always hard. A lot of your blood pressure medicines, they all have a lot of the same things. You got to pick those different things. Pick out those things that make it unique, that make it different, because 90% of the time, that's the only way I can write a test question is to find the one thing that's unique. Otherwise, there's no one right answer.
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for the advice.
Absolutely.
I have one question regarding the nursing administration of blood products. The slide that talks about the packed red blood cells at 200 per unit infused within 2 to 4 hours. Do we need to focus a lot on those to know like the time limit? And
no, as a nurse, I want you to know that information, but you don't have to regurgitate it for test. Anything else?
Okay, you decreased my stress a lot. I appreciate this. Now I know.
Really?
I was studying a little bit too much.
It's recorded. And so, you know, to get back to the recording, you just go to your little WebEx link and, you can go back to the recording and listen to it again. I've taken my notes, I've gone through everything. So I feel like if you listen to this a couple of times, you'll have everything you need to know.
Miss Altman, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I was asking a question. I think my computer may have froze up and you didn't hear me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was asking about the slide regarding nursing administration of blood products. The one that talks about like the whole blood, packed red blood cells at 250 ml per unit within 2 to 4 hours. Do we need to focus a lot about, no, okay.
No. No, I, as a nurse, I want you to have access to that information and know, but I'm, you don't have to regurgitate that for test purposes for pharmacology.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, anything else? All right, at 5:30, your announcement will go out tomorrow with your password and everything you need for the test. And then I will get the test analysis done. Hopefully grades will, my plan is grades will be released by Wednesday.
That's what I was gonna ask. So if somebody's struggling, the drop date is Friday.
Yes. I have, I am aware, y'all know that when I do the test analysis, what I do is I go through and I say, you know, I think this question was misunderstood, or I think this question, you know, maybe was just poorly written. And then I send it to Ms. Emmons, and, you know, that way we've got two sets of eyes on it. You know, most of the time we agree. There's a couple of times that she'll, you know, say, oh, well, I also looked at this one. What do you think about this one? But we have two sets of eyes that look at it. Most of the time, if y'all, if I send it to her, y'all take the test on Monday evenings. If I send it to her on Tuesday, I get it back sometime late Tuesday. And by the time I go in and make the changes and the adjustments on Wednesday morning, I can release them on Wednesday. But I know that y'all have to have them by Friday. And so I'm going to diligently work to get them released by Wednesday.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.
Nobody's going to have to drop my class, y'all.
I know I had talked to you about the exam 2 blank on our end, but on your end you see it, but in Canvas for us it's still just a dot. It's not showing, but it's showing. I know you sent me a screenshot. It's showing on your side, but not on ours.
For
the exam 2, like the spot where you could plug in and play with the numbers and stuff, it's not there. See. I know you said you can see it on your end. We just can't on ours.
I don't know why y'all can't.
I
will send Dr. Brownlee. She is our tech person. I will send her an email and see if she can go in there and look and see if there is some hidden little check mark that I need to uncheck or unmark or.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm pulling it up again. I'm in the dashboard. I'm almost there. Great. Exam 1 out of 100, exam 2 out of 100.
Yeah, it must be a system thing then.
It's published. I don't know, but I will email Dr. Brownlee. She is our tech person. She knows all the things Canvas. So I will email her and get her to like log in and look and see if there's a reason.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for trying.
I had a separate question, totally unrelated to exam 2. I don't know if you've taught this class before, but I'm kind of nervous about ATI, especially because like we brought up the discrepancies between like limits. So do you know if this ATI exam, is it pretty challenging?
What I was told is that students typically do pretty well on the ATI, but I think a lot of it just kind of depends on how much you're getting into the ATI, the far made easy. That's the only reason that is a required assignment is because if y'all get in there and do that ATI far made easy, it's supposed to prepare you for, I know it doesn't necessarily help you on a lot of your exams for us just because they cover a lot of things that we don't cover, but it is supposed to help with that ATI. And so my understanding is that students who do the ATI Farm Made Easy usually do really well on the ATI Proctored.
Perfect.
Thank you.
All right, anything else? Well wishes, it's going to go great. Believe in yourselves. Have confidence. Got this. You got this. All right.
Thank you.
I will see y'all next week.
Bye, y'all.
Right.